With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going. You're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the publisher fight back. It's time for the publisher fight back.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new Ingram power.
Hi, how's it going? And welcome to episode 2 of the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood. I'm editor-in-chief of Video Ad News, which will soon be rebranding to Video Week, hence the new podcast name. And this week's guest is Tom Rogers, the chairman of Captify. If you're not familiar with those guys, Captify are a company that specialized in using search data to boost the performance of various types of advertising. They're headquartered in London and they've got a strong US presence, and I think they're present in multiple markets around the world. And Tom is somebody who spoke at our New Video Frontiers conference in London last year, and I think anyone who was there will remember the session with Tom. It was one of the best interviews I think I've ever done. One of the easiest as well, I have to say. It was just a question of firing up a question, and Tom had plenty to say on pretty much every topic, and all of which was incredibly insightful from start to finish. I think when you hear the interview, you'll get an idea of Tom's sharp, insightful mind at work. Tom has had a pretty long career and is one of the few people who has genuinely gone into an industry and transformed it. And I think Tom's main hunting ground is the US TV and cable industry. He has served as, you know, president and CEO of TiVo for over a decade. It's easy to take this whole streaming malarkey for granted, but the DVR, really, which is a device that TiVo invented, is the one that sort of created the on-demand mindset in the heads of consumers. And before that, Tom was chairman and CEO of a company called Prime Media, which was the leading targeted media company in the US at the time. He also was president of NBC Cable, executive VP of NBC, as well as being NBC's chief strategist. And whilst he was there, he did a huge number of things. He founded CNBC, the US's leading business news channel, as well as MSNBC, which was NBC's joint venture with Microsoft. He also set up the National Geographic Channel, Court TV, the Independent Film Channel, and served on the board of A&E and the History Channel for about 10 years. He's also picked up numerous awards and is a member of a few halls of fame. And he also picked up a couple of Emmys for his contribution towards the advanced television and the development of advanced TV advertising. So I think you'll agree that that's quite a career. I don't plan to read out the full CV of every guest who comes on, but I think Tom is somebody who has done so much that it really is worth putting this conversation into context. And yeah, I hope you really enjoy our chat.
All right. We had some excitement about 10 days ago. We became grandparents, and my son, who is a pulmonologist, critical care doctor in Boston, had their first child, and it came 2 months premature, which so far the baby is doing okay in the neonatal intensive care unit. But if the baby had come a day later, my son would have been in coronavirus intensive care units caring for patients and wouldn't have been able to be near wife or baby for any of this. So, well, not great timing that the baby came prematurely, but very good timing that it came before my son was exposed. So we've been dealing with that, but so far, so good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fingers crossed. I mean, provided the baby is okay, of course. You know, I've quite a few friends who they've got, you know, babies on the way, and they're expecting them over the next few weeks. And it's just extremely anxious times in terms of, you know, will there be a hospital bed? Will there be, will the partner be able to go into the hospital to be with them? Our personal lives aside, the industry is going through a rough time. Over the course of your career, I mean, you know, you will have ridden out recessions and been, you know, at the helm of organizations. And I think many of the business leaders, you know, listening to this will be facing some difficult decisions and, have to make some, you know, hard choices.
Right.
What advice would you give them in terms of riding out the storm?
Well, this is one that really tests leadership. And I think I've been through a number of these, as you said, but this is one that I think is going to test leadership more than most. And the first thing you have to do is recognize that everybody's scared. Everybody's scared for their job. Everybody is wondering how this is going to personally impact them much more than they're thinking, how is it going to impact the business? And you have to connect with employees on that basis. And the tension there, of course, is that every company has to look at where it is and what it can afford. And in most cases, not all companies, but most cases, that's going to mean budget cuts and laying people off. And how to balance that incredible fear and anxiety on a personal employee level with the necessary steps that have to be taken is really where leadership gets tested. You have to be able to take actions quickly. You have to be able to take actions which assume things are going to be much worse than the better scenarios that you may want to believe in. Because if you get ahead of it, your business is going to be able to survive much better than if you're trying to play catch up down the road. And because you have to assume worst case scenarios, it means you're going to have to take employee actions quickly. And it is much better that people understand what those actions are and you can lay to rest some of the fears of those remaining in the organization by communicating it quickly and everybody know where they stand. I think one of the most important things when you do deliver the news to your employee base of the actions you have to take, whether they be layoffs or salary cuts, and the layoffs is really where it hurts, is you want to be providing a message of we're all in this together. We understand, and everybody understands that this is something where everybody is dealing with it. This touches everybody, rich, poor, powerful and mighty, people who are daily, hourly wage laborers. And you have to communicate a sense of being all in together. But as soon as you take actions to lay people off, there's a sense of, hey, we're not all in this together. You're making a line and you're saying some people are going to have to fend for themselves as much as you try to cushion it with some kind of payment of any kind or government help, which may be available in this case. And that really requires a delicate message, but a very important one, which is, look, everybody could go back to work and point fingers at the CEO or senior management of how ruthless they were to lay people off, how terrible it was that they didn't have the empathy of how people need their jobs more than ever on this. And you have to communicate a sense of, look, everybody could do that and wind themselves up in disgust or anger or frustration at actions like that having to be taken. But that you have to take those actions to preserve a company where most people can continue to work. And the very best thing people can do is to focus on going back to work and trying to grow the company so we're able once again to reemploy those people, to grow once again, to be the kind of place that can once again afford to bring people on. It just doesn't do any good to wish away these troubles as if actions didn't have to be taken and somehow there was a way for the corporation to survive without taking them. But at the same time, the more everybody pulls together and executes as best as possible under these conditions, the faster we're going to be able to come back, grow, and bring people back on who unfortunately had to be let go. The messaging around that, the empathy conveyed around that, the sense of understanding the pain people are feeling and the empathy they have for their fellow employees is absolutely critical. And then taking the actions and the communications related to those actions as quickly as possible to get as far ahead of this as you can. And in the media industry this time, the pain is going to be deep, and I fear it's going to be relatively long lasting.
So, I mean, bringing this into the sort of media and advertising conversation, I think we've got an industry that suffers from, you know, a certain degree of fragility in many parts. I mean, I think the agency model is probably, you know, wobblier than they'd like it to be. The, you know, publishers have been struggling. TV has been seeing declines. You know, many of the independent ad tech vendors are feeling the squeeze as, you know, the platforms grow and the large ad tech solutions grow. I mean, what you know, that was before all of this, you know. But what do you think we're going to see now, you know, that we're sort of going into what some people say might even be a depression, never mind a recession? Well, what do you think the impact is going to be on the market?
Well, I think the sectors that were weak are going to have that weakness accelerated. I think it was clear what kind of secular trends the media industry was in, traditional media in particular, and a recession was going to happen at some point. And when it did, I think the smarter analysts recognized that that was going to really accelerate those trends. And I think we're going to see that now. We're not going to, no matter when we come out of this, whether it is a deep recession or a depression, we're going to see acceleration of those trends. I think the stronger players have balance sheets to withstand this, and coming out the other end, I think there'll be that much more reallocation of advertising and marketing budgets in their direction. And the issue for some of the less developed digital players who are part of the growing new wave, but are not the Facebooks, they're not the Googles, they're not the Amazons, who are going to be hurt during this period because of the pullback in advertising budgets that everyone is going to feel. The question they have to pose for themselves is, given the accelerated decline of the more traditional businesses that are going to feel a reallocation at a faster pace away from them as we come out of that, how do the newer digital players grab some of that money? How do they position themselves as being better answers than seeing that much more of the advertising and marketing budgets going to the huge platforms that were already dominating the space before we got into this? And I think there will be increased wariness of allowing them to come out of this that much stronger, that much more mighty, and therefore a chance for the smaller and mid-sized digital players to make a case that they should be the beneficiaries of some of this reallocation.
Yeah. And in terms of, you know, new industry launches, I mean, you know, some companies, Quibi are one of the more interesting companies that, you know, are trying to launch in the middle of this, of all of this. How do you rate their chances?
Well, I never fully understood Quibi as a service, because there is so much content that can be viewed mobily anyway, including short form mobile content. And it seemed to me as if it was addressing itself to a space that was not necessarily underserved. I understand some who have seen some of the initial content think it's excellently produced and certainly would be considered premium content. I'm not sure this particular period, as much as people are spending much more time in front of screens, I think because they're home, the overwhelming amount of increased screen time is being devoted to the big screen. And to the extent it's not, it's video games. So I'm not sure, while there's a sense that, hey, more entertainment options right now are certainly welcome because people are looking to be more entertained than ever as they're cooped up. I'm not sure that a mobile new entry right now is necessarily the best place, the best timing for it, as opposed to commuting time, where I would think commuting time might be a far better place for that kind of production content to make its debut. Along those lines, I think that to some extent, both music and podcasts are not faring quite as well in this environment as you might think, because so much of the consumption related to both music and podcasts is a function of commuting or driving around or any number of things that involve being out of the house. And that's just not happening right now. Having said that, getting beyond this period, I think for a pay service up against the launch of HBO Max and the launch of Apple TV, or, you know, obviously Peacock, which for some will be a paid service, for many free. I think there are going to be so many new entrants with high quality production. And again, much of it able to be viewed mobily. I think it's going to have a very tough competitive environment relative to what a high cost operation it is. So I count me on the skeptical side of the introduction of Quibi.
Yeah, I think I feel the same. I think I can completely understand what they're trying to do in serving us in these moments where, you know, I have this experience on myself all the time when if I'm on a tube train and I start an hour long show and I have to pause it 15 minutes in. It's a very unsatisfactory, fragmented experience. It jars with me, and I end up just deciding not to bother with it because it's just not a sort of smooth experience. And I understand, and I can understand this idea of digestible content, but I think there was a term in the early days of ad tech of, you know, people would say, you know, that company, it's more a feature, not a product. And that's what this feels like. It feels like it should be a feature of Netflix, so that, you know, you have the option of watching particular shows or certain shows that are designed in a format to be digestible. But as a sort of standalone company, I agree. I think it's going to be difficult. And I say that I desperately want to see it work. And, you know, I love companies that try to do things differently and have a bit of ambition in that respect. But I think it remains to be seen. So, I mean, on the TV side, I think when we spoke in London last year, we were talking about how, you know, what will happen to, you know, live news and live sports, you know, as, you know, linear consumption declines and we go into more of an on-demand world. Currently, we've seen you know, live sports completely obliterated, whilst live news is seeing huge spikes. Do you think, you know, post-COVID, is there any hope that, you know, we'll see a sort of pent-up desire to watch live sports again, and that maybe, you know, and you know, and that news will somehow be able to retain its value in people's lives? Or you know, do you think it'll just be a return to what happened before the coronavirus kicked in?
Well, it, clearly what's going on now is totally aberrant, and we're going to come out of this, and live sports is going to come back. And I think people will have, who are sports enthusiasts, will have just as much appetite for sports if ever, and probably some pent up demand that will see sports on television flourish even more for a while. I think the issue is more the model for how sports and news gets paid. And the issue there is that streaming is totally upending the entertainment television world, with quality entertainment going to streaming services and linear television being left behind. I've only seen 1 week of ratings data since in the United States has really been in major population centers, at least in lockdown. And you really would have thought, with those kind of just incredibly unusual at-home patterns, that there would have been a much bigger bump for linear television than the ratings suggest. Broadcast network television was up some, nowhere near as much as you might assume. Some popular shows getting a real boost, but overall up at levels well below you'd think for this many people being shut in. And cable television really got very little bump at all, and continued to show week over week declines, which really surprised me. And overall, the declines continued to be double digit. What that tells me is that the streaming entertainment world is totally overtaking linear entertainment. This will accelerate that trend. More and more people will have gotten immersed in their streaming television choices. We're already at a point where there are no award-winning linear television entertainment shows. All the awards, all the buzz has gone to the streaming world. Now, what that means for sports and news is that as streaming entertainment continues to define where people want to watch that kind of programming, the cutting the cord notion, which has already begun to accelerate in ways that have brought the United States, which at one point had over 100 million cable and satellite customers, to what will pretty soon be 80 million, with accelerating trends looking like in the next few years, that'll be 50 million. And the question is, who holds on to the bundle as those trends continue? My own view has been a recession will accelerate cord cutting as people lose jobs. Paying $100 a month for a cable or satellite package when you can go to three or four streaming services for a fraction of that cost and get the primary entertainment programming that everybody's talking about anyway, that's just going to accelerate during a recession. I wouldn't be surprised, though, if we saw a little bit of lull in that trend as people are at home watching more television than ever. They may not be watching that much linear television more than they were before, but that's where the news bundle is. That's where there are more options, and people are thinking, geez, I'm home. Do I really want to diminish my entertainment options right now? But as the lockdown issues subside, I think you're going to see a real acceleration in cord cutting. And that's where sports and news really gets hit, because sports and news get more than 50% of their revenues from the subscriber fees of those bundles. And so the question is, as the world goes to streaming services for entertainment, the anchor financial anchors for news and sports are disappearing. And there's been very little work done on the part of the major media companies to figure out how they are going to exist where they're in 50% of the homes that they used to be. That's that is something that both sports and news are going to have to go at really hard to figure out what are the ancillary forms of revenue that they need to develop as the subscriber fees in the bundle diminish. And that's just going to be an enormous challenge. Now, that programming is not going to go away. I think the issue is going to be the traditional legacy players that have distributed that programming are going to be substantially weakened by what's come about. They're the ones who are the beneficiaries of the bundle. They're the ones who have to take the brunt of linear advertising continuing to diminish as viewers go elsewhere. And how they will afford sports rights is going to be a major issue, particularly with the big digital platforms like Google and Amazon, et cetera, breathing down their neck as possible players for the next auction marketplace of those rights. So that world is going to see a lot of flux. The programming isn't going to disappear, but the financial model has to change. And with that, I wouldn't be surprised to see the players who are most associated with that programming change as well.
So when it comes to the hardware devices, which, you know, do you think there's anything that are particularly going to sort of dominate long form video consumption?
Well, today, you know, Roku in the U.S. has a bit of a lead. Amazon coming on very strong. Apple TV, obviously, making major strides as well. There's a major difference between hardware in the legacy media world and hardware in the new world. In the legacy media world, if you weren't on cable and in their box, or alternatively in satellite on their box, you were shut out of a market. There really wasn't alternatives. Between multiple smart TV devices and multiple digital TV devices, from the consumer's point of view, if somehow a hardware player playing a gatekeeper role doesn't greenlight a service, you got alternatives to get the same service. You're not going to be deprived in your household of getting it. And so the hardware players have somewhat less, have a lot less leverage, except at launch. Because when you launch, you don't yet have anybody dependent on you as a programmer. Programmer leverage, content leverage grows over time. That was clearly the case with cable and satellite. Started out that the gatekeepers had all the leverage. Then once people liked the program service, got dependent on the program service, became very hard for a cable or satellite player to drop that cable service, program service. So you have some of that leverage at the outset now to get on those hardware platforms. But because of the multiplicity of hardware platforms, coupled with the fact that the hardware player's leverage diminishes over time, I don't think that will be quite the factor that it was in the legacy world by any means. I also think that the hardware form factor is going to get cheaper and cheaper, may diminish over time. I think Roku is at a distinct disadvantage because Amazon, as a major packager of content and original content, Apple as a packager of content and major content, smart TVs enabling more and more streaming services without having to make any kind of incremental purchase, Roku having the Roku channel, which is really also ran programming that does not stand out in a universe of major streaming entertainment channels that people are going to primarily gravitate to. I don't think it has the leverage of the software-hardware combination that will probably over time most determine which hardware platforms are able to get the greatest distribution.
And throughout your career, you know, you've seen the sort of industry go through a huge transition on the advertising side as we've moved more towards increasingly targeted, increasingly data-driven. TV's bread and butter for many years, and we still see that the upfronts are still going strong. Do you think we'll see bulk brand buying continuing for advertising, or do you think that might break down and we might see, you know, more niche buys, you know, according to where their audiences are?
Well, I think we're going to have a deep television advertising recession during the financial crisis. That negative growth scenario for advertising lasted 5 or 6 quarters, a little less for national advertising because it did have the benefit of upfronts, and that didn't have quite the amount of cancellation to it that spot buying does, and local television being totally reliant on spot buying probably had 6 quarters of negative growth. I think we're going to have at least that much of a downturn. I think this one, the downturn will be deeper and may well last longer. But, you know, with the last time you had cable television and television media generally, traditional television media, still in a growth mode. Prior to this, we were seeing such year-over-year decreases in ratings. We were seeing cord cutting and therefore less distribution and availability of that programming. You add a recession onto that, and I just think the fuzzier, less able to have a clear ROI answer to it, it's just going to accelerate brand advertising on traditional television, which was what has been holding up traditional television, is the notion that it still reached more people than anything else, and those brand advertisers needed scale, and you had this very unusual dynamic that the more ratings went down, the more the traditional players were able to increase their CPMs, their pricing, because people were valuing that much more the remaining scale, even though that scale was smaller. And that was just not a trend that could continue forever, because you do get to a point where the scale matters not, because it is too small to pay those kind of to allow pricing increases to define some premium for that scale. And there's going to be a real pressure on the game that is being played for the last several years as linear television ratings have diminished. Having said that, I think digital advertising, AVOD advertising in advertising-based streaming services is going to be under increasing demand for two reasons. One, it's more targetable, although a lot of the targeting aspects of that are still in its rather infant stages in terms of how efficient it truly is. But secondly, because so much of the streaming entertainment world, when it comes to the things that are driving big audiences, are subscription-based without any advertising inventory. And even where advertising inventory exists, you're talking about maybe 6 minutes an hour rather than 12 to 16 minutes an hour. The amount of available inventory in the prime entertainment television world is going to be much less, which is going to put a lot of pricing pressure on what inventory does exist. And so I think the combination of the huge downward pressure on brand advertising in the linear world, coupled with the upward pressure on new AVOD advertising, is going to create a major reallocation for television advertisers. The inventory that I think will still be a question mark in the television world in terms of how much brand appeal it will have, or whether or not it will have to develop a following among more SMB-oriented advertisers, small and medium business advertisers, the way that Facebook and Google have for so much of their advertising, is in the secondary and tertiary streaming services that are free, that are going to be advertising dependent, that are going to have pretty limited niche audiences as the major streaming services are able to garner the largest audience shares by far, and whether or not we will begin to see in a television world what we have only had in the more digitally oriented mobile and desktop world of SMB type advertising. And if that happens, that'll open up a whole new page of television advertising. But so far, I don't think we've seen signs of that developing yet.
Yeah. So, I mean, of all the just some new contenders we've seen sort of entering the TV race, you know, in all honesty, whilst there has been huge progress, I actually thought the industry or perhaps even the TV viewing experience might be even more different than it is today. But which of all the companies that have entered the race, who do you think, which company will have the most transformational impact on TV advertising?
Well, Netflix has had the most impact on television consumption, and I think will continue to because of its scale and its budgets and what this lockdown period at home will continue to do for people's dependence on it and its global reach and its ability to create localized content in ways nobody else has. But I believe them when they say they're not going to pursue an advertising strategy. And I think for the most part, that is probably the smartest place for them to be because they have the best way to watch television without commercial interruption. And I don't think they want to in any way undermine the quality of people engaging with them since they have that dominant lead. I think the company that's probably likely to have the most impact on television advertising is Amazon. It is a hardware device provider, which is the fastest growing. It is a provider of original programming. It has an enormous additional packaging of other television content beyond its originals. It doesn't get the kind of viewing time that Netflix does or that YouTube does, but it's right up there with Hulu in terms of that next level of major engagement. It has been putting together a channels type package so that it is looking to develop a way of packaging other people's channels under its banner, has not been as aggressive about it as YouTube TV has, but nonetheless is there, and has made unbelievable strides in the last few years as a digital advertising platform, growing to number three in the world out of nowhere in terms of the amount of advertising dollars it has. And everybody has spoken about how the television consumption world has gone on demand. You're no longer dependent on linear television schedules recording of linear television to create a TiVo-like on-demand presence. But literally, you know, the world is on demand. Amazon is showing its interest in television sports, nibbling at both regional sports through the Yankees network in New York and what it's done in terms of limited distribution of national packages. So its tentacles are all over the television marketplace, its advertising business is growing strongly. And what I think it will be transformational about that is we will go from on-demand program consumption to on-demand advertising. This shut-in period is clearly benefiting Amazon in ways that very few other businesses are being benefited. It is getting people that much more hooked on the immediacy of being able to order and deliver. And I think when you combine advertising with that, so that you have a sense of what people want, what they want to buy, and you can put things in front of them in wherever the ad spots tend to be located, so you can have major immediacy of on-demand purchases through television advertising, somewhat of a variant of the kind of advertising that I was talking about before, could be major brands, could be SMB type advertising, but Amazon is uniquely situated to bring that world to a television consumption model. And I think there will be enormous strides over the next 5 years that it makes along those lines.
I mean, when we talk about Amazon in a TV context, I mean the first thing obviously is that comes to mind is their data sets. Which data do you think are the most valuable when it comes to, you know, enriching the TV experience? Or you know, actually, let's step across and talk about TV measurement. Do you think Amazon hold all the cards when it comes to, you know, having that transactional endpoint? Or is there anything else in the mix of data that we might use to enhance TV measurement?
Well, TV measurement has long been more of an art than a science in the hands of Nielsen. No one else has really been able to dethrone them, because most every other measurement system has had a household measurement approach that really hasn't gotten to the individual demographic elements of that household, which is so critical to advertisers. And those that have tried to have a demographic household individual component to them have been relatively crude and haven't been able to unseat that. Somebody is going to come up with a scale approach to consumption that also provides a better way of measuring who the individual is and what they're watching. The issue today is that you have some streaming services being measured by some measurement services, streaming services themselves knowing who's watching what, but not releasing that information, or they release it in very limited form, what their top programs are, or make programming information available to studios. But we kind of have developed a balkanized world of measurement where nobody has solved both the breadth of we need more than a Nielsen panel of 20,000 homes, 30,000 homes. But at the same time, we have to solve for demographics. I don't think there's anything about Amazon per se in its programming or advertising function that may solve for that. But I do note that as a hardware player and the fastest growing of the digital hardware players, when you think about the Amazon stores that have been created, Amazon Go, and their ability to track the individual in and out of the store without any kind of cash register checkout process, my guess is they will come up with something that will enable that same kind of thing to work in the household. And now there are huge privacy implications of that, and they're going to have to figure out a system of anonymization of that and the same kind of buy-in of permission that Nielsen has when they put a meter in your house. But I think that part of the Amazon world may be in a position to solve for that.
Yeah. But another thing that comes up, you know, a sort of key problem on OTT for me personally is discovery. That, you know, I'm still searching around, often using a remote control and doing up to A and then down to Z. You know, voice is something that, you know, is often mooted, you know, as having a huge impact. I know you're, you know, as in with your chairman of Captify hat on, it's something that Captify are very interested. But, you know, who do you think is going to have an impact on advertising, and you know, what role will voice enhanced search have to play?
Well, when you think about the piece of the television world where you have, you know, demographic data has been the linchpin of television advertising. And when you think about demographic data, you think about purchase data, the part of the television world that has been sorely missing in terms of really being able to target advertising has been search data. And search data could be a truly powerful ingredient if we are going to see television advertising really grow to its full targeting potential. Purchase demographics is important to a point, but it's the nature of how revealing of it is doesn't get down really to the individual behavioral intent level. And purchase data is valuable, but it looks backwards. It doesn't look at currently what is on the minds, what is the greatest interest, passion, need of a viewer. And if you can take the television world and bring search data into it, activated through voice, makes it that much more powerful. Now, discovery is a bit of a subset of that. The discovery issues in television are horrendous because there really are very limited ways to have a universal search function where everything out there on YouTube, on Netflix, on Amazon, on Hulu, on all the major streaming services, then all the secondary and tertiary streaming services and linear channels, you can easily find what's on when, customize that interface, personalize your ability to know that. And, you know, the music world is just miles ahead, where Spotify has taken just about every piece of music ever made and gives you the ability through one interface to find any piece of music you want whenever you want. The television is not developing into a single service with a single interface kind of mode, and many of the content libraries are limiting the ability for you to do search on somebody else's platform. Over time, someone will have the leverage to solve for that. In the meantime, it is a real limitation on the consumer experience. But I think the Amazon and Apple are probably two that, for different reasons, could have the leverage to be able to solve for that over time. I think the use of broad-based search data, Amazon will certainly have a lot of search data within its four walls, but a broader world of search data that really allows you to understand the immediacy of intent of a viewer is going to be the most single valuable thing that can enhance the targeting of television. And obviously, I'm partisan on that issue with Captify because it has a uniquely suited data set for solving that.
So yeah, I mean, tell us a bit more about Captify's solution. You know, it's genuinely very interesting. I think we can do that without it being a crude sales pitch.
Well, you know, Captify recognizes that there are hundreds of thousands of publishers and e-commerce sites that are going to want to move to voice as a more not only consumer friendly way for people to interact on their sites, but the spoken word gives a degree of nuance and constant refinement of a search process that the textual search does not allow. And you combine that improvement in the consumer experience with the thought of those publishers and e-commerce sites not wanting to be further reliant on the Amazons and the big platforms for how they bring that functionality into the world, being able to control their own data, being able to be the ones that can have the most ability to monetize it by providing it elsewhere, selling it elsewhere, and Captify as the largest reserve of independent search data outside of Google in terms of the amount of monthly search data that they aggregate, coupled with a voice technology, can be that kind of independent player, providing more leverage for the independent publisher and e-commerce site to effectuate voice search and not continue to create increased dominance on the giants in the industry who have more than enough dominance as it is.
I think on that note, I think we can clearly agree. Tom, I know in London we did 20 minutes and I regretted not making it a lot longer at our last event. So it was a real pleasure to have the time to sort of flesh things out. And thanks so much for coming on, and I wish all the best for you and your new grandchild.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And it was great talking to you, and I wish you and your family safe times, and I hope for all of us, we get through this quickly, and for the media industry, it turns out better than some of my remarks suggested.
All the best. Cheers, Tom.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.